Hello and welcome to Ed Talks. This is a new podcast series which has been commissioned by the Development Office at KES and KHS to find out more about some of the former pupils of the Boys and Girls Schools in terms of what they did after crossing Edgbaston Park Road for the last time in a green or a blue uniform. My name is Ben Anderson and I've spent the last 10 years in the radio industry, first as a producer, then finally as a managing editor, and now I run Sound Rebel, a podcast production company based in Liverpool, the city that I'm very happy to now call home. I should probably say that this is being recorded in lockdown, so I'm talking to my guests over Zoom. My guest today is a writer, broadcaster, comedian, and classicist, Natalie Haynes. Natalie.
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm all right, how are you?
Wonderful. Thank you ever so much for joining me today, Natalie.
Pleasure.
Before we get too much into your career, first, I'd like to talk about Birmingham, first of all, actually. Whereabouts are you in the world now?
I'm in London now.
And how long have you been
in London? Which is like Birmingham, but not as good.
Well, I suppose that's my first question, really, is that because I left King Edward's in 2006 and I got the train on the Cross City line every single day for 7 years.
Wow, so you're like 12 or something. Wait, when is 2006?
So I'm 31 now.
It's like 15 minutes ago, so you're okay.
I tell you what, sometimes
I'm struggling with time.
It does feel like 15 minutes ago sometimes. But even just kind of getting that Cross City line every day, you look out the window and I saw the city change in the time that I was getting on the train. I mean, what was the Birmingham that you grew up in like?
Oh, I'm terrible at my own life. I'm really good at things like dates in the ancient world. I'm brilliant at those. But I honestly can tell you very little until about 2 weeks ago from my actual life. But yeah, I think I go back to visit my mom reasonably often. She's still in Birmingham. And every time I go, it seems like they've built a new road and therefore managed to build 8 million more cars. I mean, it's changed so much, hasn't it? Grand Central is shiny. You know, I still feel like the Bullring is new. And then it's like, oh no, that's the sort of grandfather of the middle of town now, because now there's Grand Central. You go, wait, what? So every time I go back, I feel like it's changed some more. I'm not sure how I'll feel when I can go back after lockdown's over and be back at... I still really struggle not to think of it as home. London is home, but Birmingham is home. I guess that's true for all of us who start somewhere and then move somewhere else. We always have two homes at the very least.
I still call Birmingham home, even though I've been living in Liverpool now 4 years, but I can't help but call Birmingham home.
I've been in London for 3 years now. But yes, I still do the exact same thing. I say I'm going home to my mom's, and then when I'm in Birmingham, I say I'm coming home to London. There's just, yes.
And have you managed to get back to school?
Yeah, I go and give talks every now and then. I think I've given out prizes twice. I basically go every 7 years when there's a new cohort that I can brainwash. I mean, congratulate on their hard work. And I went back in December to do a fundraiser for the assisted places scheme. So yeah, I go back, I don't know, once every couple of years, something like that, once a year.
In terms of your time at school then, because your career now is very creative, you know, you're a writer, you're a broadcaster. Yeah. Was that nurtured at KHS? And I suppose the reason I ask is because I've been lucky enough to embark on a creative career. And I look back on my time at school with huge fondness. At the time that I was there was a headmaster who was a wonderful man. But I suppose he was more traditional in his ideas of the kind of careers that we should pursue after leaving King Edward's. I had a meeting with him where I told him I wanted to go and study theatre at Warwick, which is what I ended up going to do. And I remember him saying, he didn't put me off it, but it's just kind of questioned, are you sure? But there were certainly
what?
Those...
you want to do what?
I suppose, well, a little bit like... And then, you know, obviously, very supportive when I did say to him, no, this is absolutely sir, because obviously it was always sir, absolutely sir what I want to do, and therefore very supportive. I mean, what was it like when you were there? Was creativity harboured and nurtured?
Nowhere near as much as it seems to be now, for sure. It was we were very academically focused. I mean, I did 11 GCSEs and... 4 A levels. I think that's quite, I don't think people do that many. The 11 thing was, yeah, you know, I think there were only about 6 of us who did that in my year. And I think very sensibly, both the school and parents, and I hope girls themselves, and in your case, boys themselves, have kind of allowed themselves to stop jumping through quite so many hoops and allow themselves to kind of spread out and be creative as well as analytic. But I definitely come from that kind of analytic era of education, I suppose. Yeah, no, I think I did a lot of critical thinking more than creative thinking. But to be fair to the school and indeed to me of the past, I don't think, not only did it not occur to me that I could have the job that I currently have when I was a teenager, I don't think the job I have existed when I was a teenager. It's like, if somebody had said to me when I was 17, could you go off to university, join the Footlights, become a stand-up comedian, do that for a decade or so, you know, kind of make a sideways move into writing op-ed for, I don't know, pick a paper, The Times, and then do that for a bit, and then start writing a book based on a column that you wrote, and then write some novels, and then sort of merge them together and do like a classic stand-up tour. You can have a radio show. I'd have been like, oh, okay. But at no point would I have thought, oh, yes, that sounds like a plausible career for a grown adult, because it doesn't. It's just, and occasionally when I go, I do quite a lot of talks in schools when I have the time, and a few over Zoom, even while kids are at school. And I quite often get asked, you know, kind of, how do I get your life? How can I have a life where I can be creative? And it's like, I don't know, but definitely don't do what I did, because it was a really circuitous route. I don't regret any of it, but I wouldn't recommend it as a strategy. I'm not particularly kind of strategic thinker, I suppose. I just tend to go, what am I interested in? Yes, I'm interested in that. What aren't I interested in? No, I'm not interested in that. And there are probably better ways and quicker ways of getting to where you want to get to. But on the other hand, I kind of feel like I carved out a career that just didn't exist. Yeah, eventually someone's going to push me off my perch and all about Eve me into an early grave. And then, you know, that'll be a noble way to go, I reckon.
I'd love to talk about Natalie Haynes' Stands Up for the Classics in a little bit.
Thanks.
Because it's, I'm delighted that you're our first guest, because you've taken something very academic, as you're saying, that kind of critical thinking and that kind of academic process, and merged it with other parts of your career and other passions of yours. I work with quite a few comedians who are doing different podcasts, and they're some of the most hardworking people I've ever met. They're constantly knackered, always on the road. I suppose, what was your route into comedy like? You started with the Footlights, and what was that kind of
really
early part of your
career?
Yeah,
really easy and then really hard.
Right.
Yeah, the being at Cambridge and doing comedy is easy, because your audience is always students and they're always delightful. And then you get out, and in my case, you join the circuit in the mid-90s. I graduated in 96, I think. So I was starting to do stand-up at the point when, you know, alternative comedy had existed for a while by that point, but there was a sort of pushback against it. You weren't getting anything like as much kind of political material. There was a rise during my time on the circuit of people like John Oliver and Andy Zaltzman doing it amazingly. But when I started out, it was a much more, it felt much more egalitarian. I think it still is probably one of the least elite art forms, because basically no quantity of having the right relatives can make you funny. No quantity of having the right. Of course, you can buy yourself, ideally, enough time to go and do open spots on the circuit to learn how to become funny. You could, if you were rich enough, afford to bankroll an Edinburgh show, but it can't make you funny. If you aren't funny, no quantity of resources will change that. You can get better at disguising it, but that's your best case scenario. And I guess the kind of flip side of that is that if you have the potential, even if it means, as you say, comedians work incredibly hard. When I was starting out on the circuit, I was teaching 6 days a week in a boarding school and gigging maybe 4 evenings a week. So I would get the train. I would do and those boarding school days finish at, you know, 6:10 or something in the winter terms, 3 days a week. So I'd finish then, run from the school to the train station, get a train an hour to London, and then, you know, sometimes come out again the other side to go digging Hemel Hempstead or something. And it was just insane. I used to get home at 1 a.m. marking books on the train home after dying somewhere horribly because I was rubbish and learning how to get good. And yeah, I'm not sure I have ever been as... Maybe when I judged the Booker Prize, I was as tired then, when I read 151 novels in 204 days. Maybe then I was as tired as I was that year that I was doing stand-up and teaching at the same time. Yeah, it was a robust time in terms of energy, I suppose, but I really wanted to be a comedian. I wanted it all the time. It was the only thing I wanted to do and to be, and I loved it. I loved doing Edinburgh, though it nearly killed me every single year. You know, it's such an emotionally ruinous thing to go and do, but on the other hand, you can't help but get better or die trying and give up, I suppose, in the act of going on stage every night for whatever it is, 24, 26 nights to an audience that the average audience in Edinburgh at the time I was going, which was 2002, 3, 4, 5, 6, was still at the time, I think, 3. I think maybe by the end of that time, it had gone up to 5. When you think how many sellout shows there are in Edinburgh in huge venues, that's an awful lot of cancelled shows with no one there. So any time that you have, you know, 120, 150 people in a room, you're winning so hard in Edinburgh. And it was a really good way, I think, of learning how to manage expectations.
When I went to university to study theatre, sometimes I felt a bit embarrassed when someone asked me what school I went to. And I don't know if it's still the case, but there was a bit of a stigma around private education in the theatre world. Did you ever find that with comedy?
I remember being, like you say, kind of embarrassed about it all. Cambridge was a bigger burden in some ways, because now, you know, the comedy circuit is as it was in sort of 1981 when Fry and Laurie and Tony Slattery and Emma Thompson were all in Footlights. There was then a sort of pushback, certainly in terms of class, through the 90s, but it's definitely swung back around. And now, you know, it's not at all unusual to have Oxbridge educated comedians all over your small screen. But at the time that I was there, it certainly felt like a thing to be slightly ashamed of. And I remember gigging with a completely brilliant comedian called Sean Locke, whose TV show 15 Stories High, if you haven't seen it, I urge you to track it down. He is an actual comic genius. And he has a real capacity. I remember him I think he was sleeping on the floor in a dressing room. Like you say, comedians are always tired. And it's a superpower, obviously, to be able to sleep anywhere. I've never had it. And just before the gig, and I walked in, and he opened his eyes and he gazed at me very beadily and said, "You must be the open spot." And I said, "Yes, my name is Natalie, hello." And he said, "Hi, I'm Sean." And I was slightly starstruck because he was a big deal then even. And he said, "So where have you come from?" And I said, "Oh, you know, Birmingham or wherever I'd driven from that night, I can't remember." And he said, "Yeah, but where have you come from?" And I said, you know, some nondescript answer. And he said, "Have you been to university? Are you a student?" And I said, "No, I graduated." And he said, "Where did you go?" And I sort of looked at the floor and said, "Cambridge." And he said, "My sister went to," and I think it was Cambridge, but I may be misquoting him. So I genuinely apologize, Sean, if I'm getting this wrong. But as I remember it, he said, "My sister went there. You know, you should never be ashamed of it. You should never be ashamed of what you've achieved." And I thought, yeah, he's right. Why am I kind of walking through this feeling embarrassed about, you know, nobody gave me this. And so I should stop being such a baby about it and face the front and kind of be who I am. But I think it is difficult when people who knew me on the circuit had no idea that, you know, at the same time I was gigging with them, I was also kind of fluent in Latin and classical Greek. It would have been hilarious for them. I remember it kind of coming out at a birthday party or something when some of my friends from college were there and also friends from the circuit, and they're like, "Wait, what?" And now is all I ever talk about. Now the idea that I ever shut up about, you know, Tacitus for 3 minutes seems insane, but I honestly did. So,
well, you're now very successfully merging your two passions with Natalie Haynes Stands Up for the Classics. Would you just give us a bit of, anyone who hasn't heard it, how would you describe it?
It is my Radio 4 show. We've just recorded the 6th series, but all of it's available on BBC Sounds for free if you would like to hear it. And basically every episode, which is about 28 minutes long, I do a kind of biography of someone from the ancient world. For the first 5 series, we did purely historical figures. For series 6, which was recorded not in front of the radio theatre at Broadcasting House, as all the others have been, but series 6, we had to record from my laundry cupboard. And so that is fictional characters, because we felt like it would be, instead of trying to do the series 6 we had planned and have it be less good, we thought, let's do something a bit more intimate and storytelling-y, and that will be nice in a different kind of way. And so, yeah, I guess it's a sort of quasi stand-up show. It looks like a stand-up show, sounds like a stand-up show. There are a lot fewer jokes than when I was doing stand-up, but there are enough. And yet it is, I hope it's Reithian. That's what we're aiming for. We're trying to be educational and entertaining at the same time. And I think mostly it works, mostly.
How did that come about then with the BBC? Was it a process of you approaching them? Did they find you?
I always say the same thing to people in audiences when they ask that. I say the act of getting into the media is basically smashing your head into a brick wall until it breaks and pretending that it didn't hurt. And I would stand by that definition. It was exactly like that. I already worked for the BBC as a reviewer, and I had done for a long time by that point. I reviewed film and theatre, particularly art, and books and television on Newsnight Review, as it once was, and then Review Show, and on Front Row and Saturday Review on Radio 4. So I'd worked with them quite a bit. I'd done some comedy and panel shows. I'd done three series of a panel show about words called Wordaholics with lovely Giles Brandreth. So I'd been working in Radio 4 for a while, and we'd been trying to find a kind of vehicle for me that would fit both me and them. And at the time, I thought I would like to do more arts broadcasting, which is, they're hardly short of arts presenters. So that didn't seem like such a good idea. And a really brilliant arts commissioner who was there at the time called Tony Phillips and I had a meeting, and we talked about classics. I'd written a book called The Ancient Guide to Modern Life, which was published in 2010. And I was already doing these kind of live shows to go with the book. I'd quit stand-up because I just didn't want to spend the rest of my life. I'd bought a flat and I didn't want to spend the rest of my life not in it. And so I guess I'd managed about not quite 2 years off the circuit. And then I sort of gradually just snuck back to performing to promote the book. And so I've just swapped a comedy tour for a book tour. Eventually, I mean, last year with 1,000 Ships, I did 70 dates. So that's more dates than I did in the last couple of years of my stand-up career. I don't know how I've got this so badly wrong, but I have in terms of being at home. But I had a meeting with Tony and we discussed how I might make the live shows, the stand-up for the classics kind of shows, the ancient guide shows, work as a radio series. And James Cook, my exec producer, came up with a title, which is a really good one, because if your name is in the title, it's just much harder to fire you. which I'm obviously always delighted about. Yeah, we did series one in, God, I should know this. I don't even know what year it is now. I think 2013, it might have been 14, I don't know. Anyway, every series I think, oh God, we'll never get commissioned again. And so far we have been, so it's been okay. But yeah, it's a joy. Making it with the audience is a real delight. But making it at home was okay. It was a bit strange, but it was okay.
Well, yes, you're talking about being at home. Of course, we're all at home at the moment with the UK
in lockdown
and the majority of the world in lockdown, of course. How different is that for you? Obviously, as a performer, you know, lots of performers do feed off the audience, and with a kind of, especially a stand-up background, do you find it difficult to produce a similar show,
I suppose? Yeah, as a performer, it's devastating. As a writer, it's completely fine. From December to the middle of February this year, I was so far behind on the book I owe, which comes out on October the 1st, 2020. Oh, wait, that's this year. Oh, yes, it's this year. I was so far behind with Pandora's Jar that I wrote 55,000 words in 10 weeks, something I simply can't recommend to you unless what you want to do is basically feel like you're having a breakdown every single day. And so I felt like I'd sort of done 3 months of lockdown before lockdown even began. It was terrible timing for me. I finished in mid-February. My deadline was the 14th of February. And at one point I contacted my editor going, well, do you work weekends? If not, can I have the weekend? I was like a junkie. I'm like, just give me 2 more minutes. And so it was quite a brutal process. And then I was due back out on the road to do the paperback push for 1,000 Ships, my most recent novel. And I had 2 weeks of it. And then obviously the tour was over. And I mean, I did, 70 shows last year. That's probably too many. There were moments when I went to do my accounts where I had train tickets for places I didn't remember going. And I thought, oh, maybe I canceled it. And then I would find like a receipt from the cafe in the train station. Go, oh, no, apparently I was there. It's like, I've got no recollection of going to this place. I didn't think I could name it. So there we go. Good talk. And so as a writer, there's not really any difference. I still go for a run or a walk first thing in the morning, come home, sit at my desk, write in the afternoons, make the thing, do the thing. So that's okay. But as a performer, God, it's so miserable not having an audience. I can't lie to you. You know, comedians are so dependent on audiences, and I guess they want us. So it's kind of a symbiotic relationship. But I've kind of found some ways around it. I did Hey Digital. So the Hey Book Festival is normally, as we're recording this, the last week of May. And on Sunday night at 9 o'clock, I did a reprise of the show I did there last year, the Troy Story, which is my show about the Trojan War, live illustrated by the cartoonist and illustrator Chris Riddell. And we did that on Sunday night, but doing it straight into camera, being able to see his drawings but not his face, having no sense of the audience, was really difficult. But seeing the numbers ticking up on the bottom of the screen telling me that there were 7,800 people watching was kind of insane. It's like, that's not you know, the radio series gets 1.6 million listeners per episode. So that's not my biggest audience by a long chalk. But it was still like, oh God, we're doing this live. Oh my God, nearly 8,000 people. So that was kind of, and we got to the end of it. It was really hot. And on Sunday night, and I have to have the windows closed because I live by train tracks. So I was trying not to let the sound bleed in and annoy the audience. And I kind of got to the end of it. I was just like, oh God, I'm so tired and hot and exhausted. But it was incredible to do. And I've been making videos every week called Ovid, Not COVID, in which at the very start, Matilda, who runs my social media stuff, said, why aren't classicists using the hashtag Ovid, Not COVID? I'm like, I have no idea. Shall we make a set of videos about Ovid? And she's like, yes, of course we'll do that. So every week I film one of Ovid's Heroides, poems written from abandoned women of Greek myth to their absent menfolk. The first is Penelope writing to Ulysses, or Odysseus as he is in Greek, but Ulysses for Ovid. And so I read the poem. It takes me about kind of half a day to read a poem in Latin, make notes on it, work out what I want to say, and then record the little film. And then they go up each Wednesday. And I think they're an A-level set text next year. So I think they've been quite useful for teachers and for students. And so that's been really nice. So we've had lots of people giving feedback about that. So I still have the sense of putting out material and it being appreciated, which is what I would have probably said I liked as a comedian. But I don't have the instant response of an audience. And it turns out I really miss that. I can't lie.
Hi, I'm Sana.
And I'm Betty, and we've been fundraising in support of the Assisted Places Scheme across each school. What's that, you ask?
The Assisted Places Scheme aims to provide access to excellence for all. So if you want to make a change,
start small and support the campaign. Thank you.
What would you say to that person who's currently at home, looking at their future, thinking they'd like to go into a creative career? What advice would you give that person who might be a little bit worried about, you know, we've seen lots of things in the news about theatres being worried about funding, generally, across the arts.
We're going to have to be worried. Yeah, we are going to have to be worried. Generally, when I go and talk to kids, I'm quite... you'd think I would be more fun than I am, but generally what I tell them is that I want them to have a plan B they don't hate, because what I despise above almost all things in terms of narratives about creative careers is what I call the winner's narrative. And an archetypal example of this is an interview with an actor in a major series in a weekend supplement, and the storyline is essentially you were down to your very last audition and you were just about to call it a day. And then you went in for this audition and you didn't think you'd get it. And you went home and you told your partner you were never going to work again and you were going to have to give it all up. And then astonishingly, you got this phone call and now you are world famous. And it's like, point the first, if you were ever in the room for a great role, as opposed to basically two lines in a scene, you were already unbelievably successful relative to most actors. You already had an agent who was able to get you seen for a major role, not a bit player role, not a day player role. It's such a deceitful proposition. And so what I try to say, boringly, to kids when I go to speak to them about having a career in a creative industry is, make sure your plan B isn't terrible. That narrative that if you kind of divert your energy to a second job that you might not hate is that you're somehow selling yourself out and it means you don't really want it. They didn't want it enough is a similarly damaging narrative. You get it over the Olympics. They just want it. Oh, really? Are you telling me that somebody who's trained at Olympic level doesn't want a gold medal? Because I'm confident they do. They're just not going to beat that person on the day. So don't make it about willpower. Because it isn't. Sometimes it's about luck or capacity and you're doing the best you can and it still isn't enough. And it's okay to say at that point, you know what, I'm just not going to win this. And that's sort of all right. So don't, please, please, young person, don't go into, for example, a writing or acting or music career thinking, I desperately want to be so successful at this that I never have to do a day job ever again. And therefore, I will train at nothing else and pursue it with all. Please don't do that, because your chances of succeeding are vanishingly small. And you know what? I just can't tell you how very few performers or writers have been ruined by having a day job they didn't hate. It's fine. It's just fine. You know, I've had loads of jobs that I wouldn't have chosen. And as soon as I could afford to give them up, I gave them up. But they were all okay. And if stand-up hadn't worked out for me, I would have gone back to teaching and I'd have been a perfectly competent classics teacher. I'm terrible at paperwork, so that may not be true. But you never know, I could have got better at it. So I think that's my main issue is pick a job which will pay bills, that will give you a... it's kind of weird for me to say it because obviously I don't have children and didn't ever want them. So I've never had to worry about the kind of expense of that. But if you think you might want a family, please don't commit to never being able to afford one. That's a terrible idea. You might want a family at some point. You might be me and not want it, in which case, excellent news, but you'll probably still need an income stream. You know, you may not get that from writing and performing. So make sure that you've got something which will pay your bills, which means you can pursue either in your spare time or part-time a job that you're very passionate about. Like I say, I taught 6 days a week when I was learning to be a stand-up, and I did that for longer than I would have liked to, and it was incredibly tiring, and I don't regret a minute of it.
I remember when I was 19 years old, I went to a talk by, it was the then controller of Radio 1, Ben Cooper, who started his career kind of producing Moyles and worked his way up, and he was a hero to me at that point, because I decided very quickly I didn't want to pursue theatre. And he said, the harder I work, the luckier I get. And that's a phrase that's always stuck with me.
Yeah, I think hard work is hugely important. But I would say resilience is the most important thing. If you could gift anything to, if you could be the, nice fairies that turn up at the beginning of Sleeping Beauty and gift, I would never give anyone beauty or talent or I would give them resilience and persistence, because those are by far the most important qualities that you can have for surviving. I think probably in any industry, to be honest with you, but certainly in creative industries, because you just will get rejected and it really will hurt. And it will hurt a lot of times. And the only thing that you have control over really is saying that hurt really badly. So I'm going to have to either get past how much that hurt and carry on making the thing I want to make, or I'm going to have to assume that the reason it hurt is because there was some truth to it. So I need to revise what I was making in the light of it. And you need to develop the capacity to discern from your responses which of those things is true. And all of that is really, really hard. And that, I think, is what I would say is the most important thing. I'm tremendously good at getting kicked in the face. I mean, to be fair, I kickbox, so I guess that I've literally trained for this. And that, I think, is the thing you need.
You've been writing recently. Is it October, the book?
I'm always writing. I have my most recent novel, A Thousand Ships, is... its paperback has been delayed. Another example of what happened. And nobody really knows how we're going to, sell it or make anything work. It's all really kind of strange. So it's still available in hardback, which is lovely. And that was shortlisted for the Women's Prize for Fiction in April. I don't even know when it is now, May.
No one knows.
In April. I know. Yeah, I always know what day of the week it is, and I never know what time of year it is. And that's true all the time, not just in lockdown. That's always true for me, because I run on the same days each week, so I have a very regimented existence. I always know what day it is. But if you told me it was October, I would believe you absolutely and entirely. And I wouldn't be able to tell if it was last year or next. I mean, I genuinely wouldn't know. I'm good at other things. It's fine. That's been a kind of crazy journey, because I wasn't expecting... I mean, obviously, you can't write a book expecting it to get shortlisted for a major prize, because you'd lose your mind. You know, that by definition, these things are a winnowing of, the thousands of books that are published every year, down to the hundreds of books that are entered for a prize, down to the, 16 books that make the long list, to get down to 6 books for the shortlist. So the whole thing has been like a kind of crazy, strange dream. And I had the email through about it during lockdown, and I wasn't allowed to tell anyone for nearly 3 weeks. And one of the people who works the prize, I texted her, because I thought, well, she'll know that this has happened. So she's basically the only person I can talk to. So I texted her, and I just texted 5 exclamation marks and 5 kisses, because apparently I'm a teenage girl. because I thought, well, then I can't get in trouble if for some reason, I'm not allowed to even speak to her. I haven't said anything. I've just punctuated. And she rang me, and it was like 8:30 or something on a Friday morning. And she just rang me to go, and I was so excited. I just couldn't tell anybody. It was completely insane. And so I was walking around. It was by anyone's standards, it was sort of cinematically odd that it felt like it was the very start of April. So it felt like the world was ending. Lockdown was on and I didn't know, you know, when I was going to see the people I care about or, you know, in darker moments, if I was going to see the people I care about. And at the same time, I was walking around with this sort of incredible secret that was making me warmer than the fever we were all looking out for could possibly have done. And so it was just kind of nuts and amazing and wonderful at the same time. I had to keep it quiet for very nearly 3 weeks before they announced it on Radio 4 on Front Row. And then obviously my phone melted, my email melted, Facebook melted, Twitter melted. And I was like, oh my God, this is a really big thing. And in a way, it was kind of wonderful in its own right. And it was also great because it made me realize I hadn't imagined it. I had to keep checking. This is so lame. I'm genuinely embarrassed repeating it. I had to keep looking at my outgoing calls on my phone to check. Oh no, incoming calls on my phone to check that my friend had called me on that Friday morning and that we'd been on the phone for 20 minutes. Because if I'd imagined it, it would just have been a couple of minutes. And then she'd have been embarrassed and I'd have been embarrassed and she was gone. At least this way, it's long enough for me to know that it must have been true because we had a proper conversation. That's how, and this is what happens to you when you're alone in lockdown. Just in case anyone was wondering, you lose your actual mind. But it was really, really magical. And at the whole same time that that was happening, I was editing Pandora's Jar, which is a nonfiction book that comes out in October. And so I was trying to keep my secrets and trying to keep my equilibrium. I'm a very rigid kind of writer. I write at the same time every day. I do the same things in the same order. And I always have been like that. And I found when the world kind of felt like it had just stopped turning, I sort of had to break my routine because otherwise keeping to it was actually too upsetting. It's like, well, I'm going for a run on Wednesday and yet the world is different and I don't like it. And so it's like, okay, well, maybe if I run on Thursday, that would be okay. Let's give that a try and see how it goes. So I was trying really hard to kind of take care of myself. And at the same time, this editing a book is really difficult. And you know, you're trying to, it's like, it's a nonfiction book. In an ideal world, I'd be in a library checking sources and I can't do that. So I've just had to write in the bibliography at the back, this book was edited during lockdown, and hope that people will understand that I really did do my best with the kind of resources that were available to me at the time. But it's been a strange, mad time to be a writer. But I'm really, really conscious of the fact that there is probably, at most, there are maybe 5 people who feel luckier than I do in the writing world at the moment in this country. So I should just really relish it, I think.
Natalie, I'm very happy to say you haven't imagined this conversation. Thank you so much for your time. It's been really great to speak to you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Ed Talks. I hope that you've enjoyed today's conversation. If you have, it would be great if you could subscribe to this podcast on whatever app you're listening on so you can keep up to date with future episodes. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, then we'd really appreciate it if you could leave your feedback in the review section. If you're listening on a platform where you can't leave your comments, then please do email me with your feedback. My email address is ben@soundrebel.co.uk. If you would like to feature on this podcast as a guest, then please email Adelaide Bailey at the Development Office. Her email address is aab@kes.beham.sch.uk. That's aab@kes.beham.sch.uk. She's also the person to email with any news that you think should be featuring in Old Ed's publications, either in print or online. Finally, if you think a podcast would enhance the communications of your business, organisation or charity, then I'd love to talk to you about producing it. My email address again is ben@soundrebel.co.uk. Thank you again for listening, and I hope you'll join me again.